Charles Burnett's film Killer of Sheep was declared a national treasure by the Library of Congress in 1990 and was among the first 50 films entered in the National Film Registry for its historical significance. And yet it's likely you've never seen it or even heard of it. It's finally being released in New York tomorrow, 30 years after it was made, so what took so long? With me now with some answers are Ross Lipman, the UCLA archivist who is responsible for restoring it, Henry Sanders, who plays the star, Stan, Douglas Doros, vice president of Milestone Films, and Danny Glover, who's worked with Charles Burnett on two films, To Sleep with Anger, that was in 1990, and the upcoming Nujoma. And I'm very pleased to welcome all of you to the show. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Now, Henry, had you given up on this film ever being released?
Oh, yeah. It was just a nice film in 77, 78, and that was the end of it.
Charles Burnett has said that it was never made for just entertainment. It was for discussion. So maybe that's one of the reasons. But would you agree? Did it spark a lot of discussion at the time?
I don't know. I mean, it was one of those things. It was a job. You do the job, and you go on and just hope something happens with it. And it was really a good film. It really was. I mean, it gave me chills. There were certain scenes in it that really gave you chills. I mean, the reality of it.
Well, after you worked on it, did you go around with it when it was shown at film festivals? And it did open in a couple of places, didn't it?
And festivals and some colleges. And I had heard about it. In fact, in 1990, a friend of mine called me and said, you're a national treasure. And I said, okay, what does that mean?
Well, Dennis, it had to have been shown in some theaters to be put in the National Film Registry. It also got the Critics Award at the Berlin Film Festival in 1981. When did you first become aware of it?
Well,
now I'm asking Dennis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, I saw it in college back in the 70s when I was at Ohio University, and I loved it, but I didn't really think anything of it. I just always assumed it was there, and it's a masterpiece, and it was available. And in 1999, I was talking to Ross Lipman here, and I said, what are you working on? And he said, Killer of Sheep. And I said, I want it.
For your company?
Yes.
Because you are the president of Milestone Films.
I'm vice president. My wife, Amy, is the senior partner of the company.
Now, what about you, Danny? Had you seen Killer of Sheep before you worked with Charles Burnett?
I saw a rough copy of Killer of Sheep. About 1988. Mm-hmm. In fact, I knew of the film. I knew of that film and also My Brother's Wedding. But like everyone else, it was a hard to, I saw My Brother's Wedding, but it was hard to come by Killer Sheep.
Do you think that one of the things that makes this so startling is how differently it depicts the lives of black people, especially black males?
Well, I think Charles was on to something, and you see a lot of what ultimately became To Sleep with Anger in Killer of Sheep.
Which he made 13 years later
with
you.
Which he made 13 years later. And there's the way in which he juxtaposes different images within the framework, within the visual language of the film, I think is very powerful. And certainly the visual language is so powerful in this film. Not only the sheep, but the children, in a sense. In fact, I was thinking about that as I saw the film in its entirety as something that you didn't have to figure out what was going on. As a complete, what you're going to open at the theaters. And I saw that, and I saw just the moments, you know, with the kids. Always this point of being just that close to danger, whether it's the kid under the train track, under the train wheel, or the kids leaping over there's always that. It's a symbolism in a lot of ways in terms of how we see our children. And I thought, I think what he did was incredible. What he did is the film foreshadowed what we see now in our communities.
Well, to back up, because the people haven't seen this film, we see a lot of kids, mostly boys, a few girls, but mostly boys, and they're all engaged in group activities. They're constantly throwing rocks at things, and they are climbing all over the railroad tracks, and they're leaping from rooftops and engaging in all sorts of physical contact, often with some kid left crying. And then we see the adults, and they are living rather difficult lives, trying to get by in Watts. Stan, the main character, is one of the few people who actually has a job, and his job is as a killer of sheep. He works in a slaughterhouse. And Henry, that job really depresses him, doesn't it?
Yeah. In fact, I gave up eating lamb after doing that. So I don't eat lamb anymore.
How you doing, Henry, man?
How you doing? I don't know if you remember me, Danny.
Do you remember you? I do.
Okay,
yes, I do, brother.
From Los Angeles Actors Theater.
Like way back. We go back from the day. Back in, in the early 70s, you know, mid-70s, late 70s, yeah.
Well, can we say this film has a plot? Not much really happens, and yet we get so involved with all of these people.
There is a very, very loose story about Henry trying to fix his friend's car, and they kind of come back to this throughout the film.
And you really had to carry a heavy motor.
Oh,
is it as heavy as it looks?
Yeah, I mean, the scene was funny once you viewed it, but the difficulty of taking up two stories, coming down the back stairway, carrying this heavy engine all the way down, lugging it over to the truck, putting it on the tail of the truck, and then watching it roll down the streets. I mean, it was a funny scene, but the thing was heavy. It was definitely heavy.
Had you had experience with this sort of life?
I grew up in Houston in the projects, and the thing about throwing rocks at trains and throwing rocks at each other, I can definitely identify with that because, you know, growing up, that was part of our plaything was, you know, we didn't have much of anything else to do, so you would create things to do.
Now, it was you're one of the few people who actually were professional actors. The rest of them were non-professionals. Did that make this more complicated? Doing because it really does feel like everybody was totally typecasted, that the guys who robbed houses probably looked like they really did burglarize people on the side when they weren't being filmed.
Yeah. Well, Charles knew the community, and a lot of the people Charles worked with were people that he knew from the area, and he, you know, had spoken with them and said, "Do you want to be in the film?" And of course, the majority of them said yes, and went on from there.
It feels really unscripted. Made me wonder if there was much improvisation.
There was some, and Charles would, you know, outline what he wanted, you know, when those things were improvised, like the stuff with Casey and myself. He would, you know, outline the things that he would want, and we would, you know, work around it and come up with something that he was happy with.
Now, Danny, you were already acting at the time this film was made.
No, not really. You know, I wasn't. I was working in community development out in San Francisco in the Model Cities program in 1977 when this film was made. But a lot of the images remind me of images when I lived in the projects in San Francisco. You know, and I remember this right in the projects. I lived on the 19th Street projects. There's this tunnel, and as always these trains came, we always found a way to be playing around the tracks. You know, it's always some relationship that you have with playing around the tracks.
I was thinking back to the films that dealt with African American life at the time, and they were either very political or blaxploitation. And this film is neither. In fact, one of the critics said, "I'm not so sure that it's a film. It may be a piece of sculpture." And when you see it, you kind of understand that there's something. Yeah. There's something so universal about this film. You feel like this is the way it really is, and may still be in a lot of parts of this country.
And I'm sure it is. You know, I think if you show this film today in New Orleans, you know, the aftermath of New Orleans, of New Orleans before the hurricane, people would be able to relate to the film. There's a really fine line, just as I was looking at the film, between fantasy and misery, you know, on the one hand, but that Charles brings about so vividly in this film, you know, whether it's through the eyes of children, the little girl singing The Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And the juxtaposition of those is quite extraordinary. Yeah.
My guests are Danny Glover, star of other films by Charles Burnett, To Sleep With Anger in 1990, and the upcoming Nujoma, Where Others Wavered, which is a biopic of the first Namibian president, Sam Nujoma, and that's in post-production, I understand.
Oh, yes, it is.
Henry Sanders is talking to us by phone. He plays Stan in Killer of Sheep. Ross Lipman is the UCLA archivist responsible for restoring Killer of Sheep, and Dennis Doris is the vice president of Milestone Films. Killer of Sheep opens tomorrow for its first theatrical release at the IFC Center. Now, Ross, how did you come in on to this project?
Well, I'm a restorationist at UCLA, as you mentioned, and I restore films dating back from the dawn of cinema to the present, but I've, over the years, developed a specialty in American independent cinema, and I was very fortunate that shortly before I was hired, UCLA had received a $1 million grant from the Sundance Institute to preserve classics of American cinema, and hadn't really begun, so when I got there, it was just waiting for me, and Killer of Sheep was one of the very first projects I was able to do.
That was in 16mm.
Yeah.
What condition were the prints and the negatives in?
Well, the prints were all horribly battered, but normally when you restore a film, you don't want to use the prints. You prefer to go back to the original camera negative that was, you know, running through the camera when the film was shot. And in this case, Charles had it, and it was already deteriorating. One of the things that surprises people when they hear that I'm working on films that are considered relatively recent, like the 1970s or 80s, as well. Why does that need to be restored? It's not from the 1920s.
And it's black and white. Color sometimes gets distorted, but black and white usually holds up.
Well, the image quality can hold up, but even recent films can suffer from something called vinegar syndrome, which was the case with this. The film stock begins to deteriorate, and it can warp and buckle, even if it's black and white. Now, in the case of Killer of Sheep, it did actually have this what's called illness of film. However, luckily, it was early enough that the image had not, the film had not buckled and distorted, so all the quality of the original was still there. However, the interesting thing about it is that when Charles did the original post-production work on the film in the 1970s, it was, of course, a student film that he made at UCLA. He had very little money, and the post-production work was never to Charles's satisfaction. In fact, he even mentioned that one of the things he was trying to achieve with the film, which he was very successful at, was an in-the-street kind of feel. He wanted you to feel as if you had just set the camera down and recorded these people's lives. And he really managed to do that. But part of the problem with the low-quality post-production was a lot of the beautiful quality of the cinematography was really not present in the 16mm prints. They were, in fact, I remember when I first saw it, I was also a student back in the 1980s, and I thought, what is this? I don't know what I've just seen. And it was partially due to the murkiness of the image quality. And then when I got to work on the restoration, I was like, oh, look at everything that's in there. It was really an eye-opening moment.
It's a gorgeous film. So the restored version is better than it was when it was first shown?
Well, I guess you're not supposed to say that, but I do think that in this case, I think that it is, because we went through such careful printing tests to you create intermediate elements before you get to the final print, and we carefully tested this. I spent months and months doing this, as I always do, to work on that, to bring out all the image quality that was there in the original photography. We're not adding anything beyond what Charles photographed, but the final print that you see on the screen is superior to the older prints, and we also worked very similarly with the soundtrack, which I can...
Yeah, well, let's talk to Dennis a bit about the soundtrack, because I've read that this is the reason this film could not be released in the past, because he hadn't gotten clearance, and it's got a lot of music, songs by Etta James, Dinah Washington, Paul Robeson, Louis Armstrong, and then some people that I remember from the 40s and 50s who are largely forgotten now, like Cecil Gant and Faye Adams. I don't think I've heard shake a hand since the 50s, but it was such a big hit at the time. He couldn't get clearance for these? How expensive would that have been?
Well, as Henry and everybody said, it really wasn't a film to be shown in theaters. He wanted it as community activism. He wanted it seen by people in the community and around and to talk about the black experience. And the soundtrack really was, after working on it for about 6 months, I called him up and said, did you mean this to be sort of a history of African-American music? He said, that's exactly what I wanted. I wanted a whole span of accomplishment.
But he also wanted that music to tell part of the story, because when we hear Dinah Washington sing This Bitter Earth, we know that cuts a lot of different ways.
Well, Charles is a great director. He is also a great, he thinks as a composer. He thinks in terms of music as well. I had talked to Ross about this. He knows just about every piece of, you know, any song that you can name. And it does reflect on the film. It does talk about the film. It's a gorgeous soundtrack. It's 18 songs and 34 rights, I happen to know.
And you couldn't get a couple of them, I gather, even now.
Actually, we only could not get one. The publishing rights for Unforgettable with Dinah Washington. It's not the performance right, it's the publishing rights, which means you can't even use a song. And we took 2 years trying to get that rights, and we'd call every now and then and try to be charming and try to explain what the film was. And it just, we had two cease and desist letters and a threatened lawsuit. By the time I got the point, finally, and I just called Charles and said, we just can't use this. And he said, that's okay. And together with Ross and Charles, we chose to use This Bitter Earth as a reprise at the end.
Now, Henry, did Killer of Sheep lead to more parts for you?
Ultimately, there were a couple of directors. Well, initially, there were three directors that I met at UCLA, a guy named Bobby Roth, Jamal Fanaka, and Charles. And I worked with all three of them on various projects. And ultimately, you know, some TVs, a few people had seen the film, and, you know, it leads to an interview and leads to other things. So, yeah, ultimately, it really did kind of help propel the career.
Although I suspect it had nothing to do with you being in Rocky Balboa last year.
Well, that was a surprise to me, just even getting cast in it, which was great.
I hear you're directing a play in Los Angeles called The Providential Occurrence. What's that about?
Well, it's a piece that we've worked on for about 10 years. It was initially called The Amistad, and long story short, we were at HBO, Susan DePass, like the treatment that we had. She had a deal with HBO. We went to HBO, and Spielberg was at HBO with the same project with Debbie Allen. We didn't realize that it had been around as long as it had. And we saw Spielberg's version. We felt ours was a little more intimate. And a few years later, we decided, why not do a play and call it A Providential Occurrence?
And now, I love the fact that you use that word intimate.
Yeah.
It tells us so much.
His was a huge, huge scope of events. And ours, we wanted to deal with the people and how the people felt and what they were going through. And we added a little twist to it. And the name of Providential Occurrence came from Baldwin, who started the abolitionist movement, and he, when the Africans were brought in, he was the one that said this could be a providential occurrence for us to kind of have the movement expand and have more people involved in the abolitionist movement.
And Danny, you're all over theaters now, not only in Dreamgirls but also in Shooter, A little while back, you were in a Malian film with a small part in a Malian film called Bamako. You're working a lot these days.
Well, I chose to produce, along with my company, Louverture Films, this film by a really talented director who's Mauritanian and Malian, Adura Mansasako. And it focuses on the African debt. And I like the word intimate that Henry also used, because it's an intimate story about the impact that the debt has on ordinary people's lives, the structural violence that happens with a certain conditionalities with the World Bank and the IMF, which distort people's lives, destroy their lives, you know.
But I found certain links between it and Charles Burnett in the fact that Charles Burnett at the time seemed to be pushing at the envelope of what films look like. Jim Hoberman of the Village Voice called it one of the two great independent films of the 1970s. And then you have this director who seems to be reinventing movies again.
Well, you know, because the story is nonlinear, because he uses another way of telling, of presenting the story to us, there's a lot to you know, to draw on from also from To Sleep with Anger, as well as Killer Sheep, you know, and Charles's vision of filmmaking, and certainly they both depend a great deal on the visual language, you know. The visual language in Killer Sheep, as I said before, is just quite extraordinary, as well as that in Bamako, you know, in the way in which they both use the whole scope of storytelling in the process of conveying the point. And you're moved by that, you know. I mean, the movement from, I'm looking, thinking about Killer Sheep, from the point where we're with the children to have us at the slaughterhouse. The juxtaposition of those two images are extraordinary and very powerful at the same time.
We should also point out that Killer Sheep has a fair amount of comedy in it.
Oh, yeah.
It, we've been making it sound like it's this, this really ponderous film. But it's very funny.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Charles loves his characters. Charles loves people. And you can see how much he adores everybody in Killer Sheep. And the actors just come through. I mean, Henry is fantastic.
Yeah, you're wonderful, man. I mean, I didn't really get a chance to see it, but your work is just wonderful, man. It's beautiful. Henry.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ben came to see A Providential Occurrence.
You did? Ben Guillory.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Ben Guillory, associate of mine. We have a company called Roby after Paul Robeson. We have a theater company down in Los Angeles. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So he came to see it, and?
Oh, no, he came to see it, and he really enjoyed it. I wasn't there. I was doing Driving Miss Daisy in San Diego at the time. So I was kind of running back and forth between Providential Occurrence and Driving Miss Daisy, so I missed him. But I heard he was there, and he had some really nice things to say about the show.
Yeah. But, you know, it's that funny scene, the scene where they come up to buy the body engine. That had me rolling on the floor. The scene when they come around the end, the guy's laying there with his head bandaged up. Another guy's with this funny outfit playing.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Woman's sitting up there, and he said, and he sees her rubbing her legs down. He said, How come we ain't never got together? She said, you wouldn't know what to do. He said, you about as tasteless as a carrot.
Yes.
I was rolling on the floor.
We should also point out, with all of the argument over the N-word, it's mentioned quite a bit here. But what you bring up, Danny, is brings up another interesting thing that Charles Burnett does. He, in a scene where some action is happening, there's other action happening. There's always something else happening. Kids are doing somersaults in the street while the adults are carrying this heavy engine, and it really makes you feel like there's a community. It's multi-layered. Life is a lot more complicated than just one person's story.
Yeah.
Well, Charles is, as I said, a great director, and the reason he's great, and I think Henry can talk more about this, is that he did have, even at that age, he was 27 or so, he maybe 30, he really had an exact idea what that film was going to be. I think he had every frame in mind before he even started the film. And he really is. I haven't met many directors like him, maybe two or three others in my career that are that brilliant, that good.
Well, one of the interesting things about the way that he constructs the film, too, is that if you watch it enough times, which I've done many times in the course of restoring the film, you see all sorts of things emerging. And when you watch a film many times, you really learn how good it is. And Charles's Killer of Sheep really holds up about as well as anything I've seen in terms of new layers coming out. I'm always discovering new things. Anyway, the way that he constructs the film is that you'll find that there are actually loose narratives, but you need to watch it many times for them to emerge. For example, you might be following a character from scene to scene, but you don't even know it because there's so many characters that are appearing before you, and you don't know which ones are going to become the important ones as it goes along until you're a little further into it. So you'll see that original idea. For example, you might be following Stan's son. Stan is the character played by Henry. Along in the course of his day as he goes and throws rocks at trains and things like that, or passes by the people who happen to be burglarizing a house. And so Charles then fleshed out a scene around what happens to Stan's son during his day. And then the scene takes over. And then by the time that it's shot, Stan's son is really almost incidental in those particular moments, but they're traces of what are there, and that's part of what makes the film so rich, and you can come back to it as you then start to understand how it's all working together.
Now, how long did you work on restoring this film?
It took me about a year and a half. I originally restored it in 1999 and 2000, and it took about a year and a half to do the work, and then Dennis had the lion's work of clearing the music rights, which took 7 years. And then, of course, we then had to do new work to get this new release out, including regrading a number of scenes.
Well, how would this compare with, let's say, going back and doing something with Greed or another classic that might be in different states of deterioration?
Well, each project that I work on presents an entirely different set of problems. One of the earlier films that I restored was Tilly's Punctured Romance, Charlie Chaplin's first feature, and that was really a film where I had to recreate the entire continuity of the film because it had been re-edited and re-released so many times that it was chopped to smithereens, and we did actually manage to create what I believe is almost identical to what audiences saw, but that was really a content restoration. In terms of Killer of Sheep, it was really focusing in on, like I said, the visual quality before, also the soundtrack. One of the great things that Charles did was he wasn't revolutionizing just film content, but also the working methodology. The cast, including a lot of the children who you see throughout the film, were his crew, and they actually took turns running the sound. And you get this wonderful in-the-street feel to most of the sound, because 90% of it is the actual sound that was recorded at the time. But it's also very rough, and at times it was very obscured. In the old prints, you really couldn't make out a lot of the dialogue. And what we have to do is to go in and very carefully work to make the dialogue audible, but without changing that in-the-street quality. You really want to feel like you're there and not have this feel like it was shot on a Hollywood soundstage. So we're not overdoing it in terms of making it crystal clear, but there are little things that we can work on to highlight the dialogue and the audibility, and that's what we worked on. Mm-hmm. So it was really quality and nuances for Killer of Sheep.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Good luck, Danny, in another new film you have, Michel Gondry's Be Kind, Rewind.
Yeah.
That's coming out soon?
That's going to come out in September, but it's really an ode to Fats Waller. That's what the film is, you know. It's a beautiful film about imagination, a collective imagination.
And Henry Sanders, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, Henry.
Take care, Danny.
I hope you're as good an actor now as you were then in 1977 when you played Stan in Killer of Sheep. Ross Lippman is the UCLA archivist responsible for restoring the film. Dennis Durris is the vice president of Milestone Films, which is now releasing it. And it opens tomorrow at the IFC Center for its first theatrical release in New York City. We're sorry we couldn't get Charles Burnett here, a great director who is right now in Europe doing post-production on another film that Danny Glover is involved with called Nujoma, and I'm sure that'll be great too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye, Henry.
Bye.